Welcome to a special edition of the Texas Hour with Pratt on Texas, featuring an interview with a thinker, writer, doer, or someone with an interesting story to tell.
It's a pleasure to visit with Dr. Merrill Matthews of the Institute for Policy Organization, one of our great friends for many years, a true Texan himself, living in the Metroplex area. Dr. Matthews, for people my age, and I'm in my early 50s, moving to the mid-50s, they were most, unless they were like me in a household that was paying attention to politics, they were probably in junior high, grade school, you know, this area, the late 70s, they were in grade school and then junior high when Ronald Reagan came and was the great dragon slayer of inflation. And unless they were in a position where they were having to pay a lot of attention, even people in their 50s now have a small understanding of what was going on with this monster and why it is one of the greatest things, the most feared things that there should be, and that is inflation. Talk for a moment. I mean, you're an economist. You have the Janet Yellen, who's, you know, one of these financial people, part of the administration, saying that, yeah, we're going to have an inflation surge, but it's, quote, a plus for society's point of view. They're trying to color inflation as a positive, whereas the Germans at Deutsche Bank issued a stark warning about rising inflation. Economies are, quote, sitting on a time bomb. Now, those who don't know their history don't understand that the entire Nazi party came about partly because of the downfall of the German government after World War I because of how pernicious inflation is. Inflation leads to revolution. It leads to all kinds of things. It is one of the most pernicious things possible. So the Germans made the mark, the Deutschmark, even when they were recovering from World War II, one of the soundest currencies in the world. Didn't matter if the left was in charge or the center right or whatever. All through that Cold War period, the Deutschmark was very, very strong because they understood how horrific inflation is. Meanwhile, you know, Great Britain, the so-called victor, was essentially bankrupt at the time that Margaret Thatcher took over. The United States was headed in that direction. And now we've got an administration praising the idea of inflation. I know that's a long setup. But I'm deeply, deeply concerned because people who are my age and even slightly older really remember the term, but they don't remember just how all-encompassing it is as far as creating absolute misery and poverty and instability. Would you please talk about that?
Well, of course, the misery is part of the misery index, which was the unemployment and the rate of inflation added together. And, of course, in Jimmy Carter's period, he wins in 1976, is ousted by Reagan in Carter's bid for re-election. But I still remember people in that time and shortly thereafter, because it took a few years to get inflation under control, I still remember a friend who said he had just gotten a loan for a new house at 15% interest rate, and he thought he was fortunate to get it at 15%.
The only condominiums in Lubbock, in a city like Lubbock, which is quite a bit smaller city at the time, were all built in that time period. You know, they've never been that popular. I mean, they're popular for vacation places, but they were built in that time period, and they were built for a reason. Inflation made it impossible to own a home, so they did everything they could to, you know, fractional ownership, multifamily, anything to reduce the cost because the payment, the principal would be such a tiny part of the payment, the actual cost of the house, but the inflation part, the interest rates were so awful.
Right, and then Jimmy Carter actually appointed Paul Volcker to be head of the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank. Paul Volcker came in, and he decided he was going to whip inflation, and he took a number of steps, including reducing the money supply and so forth. It took a couple of years to work through, and that bled on over into the Reagan administration for a couple of years, but it finally got it under control, and then for the last, decade and a half, two decades, inflation has been really quite low compared to normal standards, and especially in the last decade. And that's, people just don't realize what inflation can do.
Well, explain that to them. Explain to what it does to everything, because it's a tax on everything. you know, people say, well, my house got more valuable, you know, and I remember some people saying, well, it wasn't so bad. Our house became, yeah, but every other house became more valuable, more had a bigger price too. It's like my market right now. I can't sell my house at the peak of the market because there's no way to enjoy the value, the gain, because every other house costs that much more. There's no real gain in this, and everything you hold in value and cash and things like that, it's simply eroding by that rate every day.
Right, and it hurts people on fixed incomes the most because their prices go up, but they're not getting an increase by and large in their income coming in. So if they're on a pension or Social Security, they struggle the most under this. But in addition, people who want to go out and buy a house or something, if you're having to pay significant amounts of if the interest rates are high because this filters through and puts high interest rates in there. So it filters all the way through the economy. And then, of course, as prices go up, people demand higher wages in order to be able to afford what they're doing, what they want to be able to buy. So it creates a real drag on the economy. And then one key aspect of this is the federal debt, because the federal government has to pay interest on the federal debt. And we have we've actually had it's been merciful for the last decade or so where interest rates are really, really low. The interest rates on the federal debt has been low, and that's allowed Washington to continue borrowing huge amounts of money because it feels like it really doesn't have it's cheap money, so they're not having to come up and pay real interest rates on that. So it creates a real problem for us.
But this is exactly what happens to countries, though. When the interest rates do go up because you're in this inflationary environment, then all of a sudden that money that's been borrowed is no longer, you're no longer able to borrow it cheap money. And then you see collapse of governments, or what, you know, they would call not this BS out of the European Union austerity that wasn't in the last decade and a half, but you begin to see real austerity where not only does business end up laying people off because they can't raise their prices fast enough to keep up with the increasing cost, government actually begins to stop doing things. And it's not the pretty kind of things. It's even down to basic functions.
And, of course, one of the things that governments do in response is they create more money, they print more money, or they create more money in order to be able to pay these things. And that's we're there already. The Federal Reserve Bank has been creating massive amounts of money really over the last decade, but in the past 4 or 5 years it has done this as a way of what they call quantitative easing and other things. So the Federal Reserve Bank can create money out of whole cloth. It doesn't really print so much. It just does it on the balance sheet. It creates money
for the banking system, right?
The benefit so far, and the question had been over the past several years, is why haven't we seen inflation tick up? And the economists are sort of circling around a reason that most of this money has been just held. So the federal government said, the Fed created money, gave it to the banks, but forced them to hold that money as a reserve on their banking reserves. So a lot of this money has been just sitting in bank accounts and not being spent. And where inflation really comes in is when money starts circulating. You get what's called the velocity of money as money is turning over faster, and that starts pushing you start seeing the higher prices and so forth coming in. So we've been fortunate for a couple of reasons. Number one, over the past decade, 15 years, we've outsourced an awful lot of our manufacturing to China and other places, which kept prices really cheap because of the cheaper labor and other things that were there. So that kept prices down. And then, of course, the Fed has created a lot of money, but that money has not really entered in circulation so much, and that's kept prices down. So the two things together have kept a tap on inflation.
Explain to people why increasing the money supply, and maybe we should quit using the word inflation, because in inflation, what it does is it means the money you have, the money you've saved, the things you have that are more liquid become worth less. If you have a 10% inflation rate every year, that means your $100 at the end of the year is only worth $90. It's in purchasing power, generally speaking. And so it's a tax on everything you have. When you create more money in the money supply, if you create, let's say you have, there are only 10 bulldozers in the world, those bulldozers are going to be very valuable, and they're going to be paid for by the people that have the deepest pockets to bulldoze trees out of the way or whatever they need them for. If you increase, and so they bid for the use of those. And if they increase the number of bulldozers, they add another one here, that'd be 10% in a year, then they add another one, and you keep adding this, the value of those bulldozers, the price of those tends to go down. It's exactly what we see with space launches, with SpaceX. The more launches you can make, the more quickly you can turn them around and do it, the price goes down for those. And it allows more and more people to enter that market. Well, in inflation, when you put money into the system, if they held it back in Federal Reserve accounts, okay, it's not circulating in the economy, so it didn't have the pernicious in effect that you might have thought. But once that's out there, the money you have becomes worth less because there's more of it. Does that make sense? Can you explain that to people? Because I'm running into folks who know inflation's a bad word, but they really don't understand why.
Right, so there's a certain amount of goods and services within the economy, and you've got a certain amount of money, and that money sort of relates to the goods and services. If, to take it as a simple example, you double the money, but you haven't changed any of the goods and services, ultimately that money sort of filters in, and the price of those things essentially double over time. And that's what's happened in a number of countries. We saw this in Zimbabwe here not long ago. I think it's still a problem, but when Robert Mugabe was there, it was the biggest import for in Zimbabwe was the Zimbabwe currency that came in, and people were carrying around $1 trillion notes,
right,
and couldn't buy a banana with it because they had inflated the money so much. And this is typically a response of governments as a way to try to pay their debts, especially if they're heavily indebted, so they inflate the money by creating more so that they can pay their debts, but then each of those, let's say, dollars is worth less because there's more of them. That's a standard government response.
And there are two kinds of, and by the way, it's not just backwaters like Zimbabwe. The U.S. has been through it all through the 70s. We've been through it at other times. Brazil, a major economy, has been through it. Mexico, I remember when the notes, when I used to go to Mexico, the notes were 10,000 pesos. And finally, they just cut off the zeros and started over again, you know, literally.
Right. That's
literally
exactly
just
right.
Reissued currency with fewer zeros on them. But it doesn't change the situation. And I have personal friends who had very big businesses in Mexico. And they lost everything in these devaluation regimes that came about because of inflation and other bad economics. There are two different kinds of inflation, I guess, as a consumer. One is a good kind of inflation, and there's nothing wrong with it. And that means the currency remains stable, but prices go up because of demand. And that's what leads to invention and new things and new ways of doing things, because everybody wants that. The price goes up, the people profit that sold the service, that leads other people to invest in new ideas along the same line, but the currency always kept its value. The other kind's the kind you're talking about, and that's inflation created by government, doing witchcraft with the currency. And that is pernicious. I mean, it literally bankrupts people. It leads people to poverty. I want you to talk a little more about the effects. You started to talk about housing in the beginning. You know, credit card interest rates were way up there. Housing interest rates got up to, in the upper teens. Explain to people what that means, because right now they're running around buying houses like crazy, buying houses far more expensive than they would have bought even 5 and 6 years ago. And they can afford the payment because the interest rates are so low. Explain to them what happens when you get inflation and you have the value, the money gets cheaper and interest rates go up. I mean, you get squeezed from both sides.
Right. And one of the problems that we had in during the early 2000s, which led to the housing crisis, was a lot of people got adjustable rate mortgages, which is I'm buying more house than I can really afford, and they're going to give me a really low interest rate now. But if interest rates go up, my interest rate, the interest rate on my mortgage goes up, and that caught an awful lot of people in a bind. I had a situation, we bought a house that we're living in now in 2005, and the mortgage company was saying to us, you know, you can look, or you can get a lot more house. We can give you an adjustable rate mortgage, and you can get a lot more house if you're willing to take a low interest rate now. But if the interest rates go up, you have to pay more. And I said, absolutely not. I want a set interest rate.
You know, no different than what we saw in the power grid thing in Texas, where people bought wholesale floating rates from a few vendors like Gritty, and you know the government's out there saying, well, we shouldn't have that. No, we should. That's a freedom issue. But that's how big of the pinch it is. People were shocked when they heard that people got $10,000 electric bills.
Right. Well,
because interest rates can do the exact same thing, and this is what it does to the housing market. I mean, and don't think it means, well, we can all go rent apartments, because the same rates in the exact same situation applies to people who build apartment buildings, so rents have to go up as well.
And it pushes everything up, but that interest rate is a major factor in how much people can afford for a house. So normally, you know, historically, if we were sort of looking at a 4 or 5% interest rate, that was considered pretty good.
Right.
It sometimes got down to 3, even 2.75 or something. That was considered great. But if you start pushing the interest rate up much past that, people get caught in it and they can't afford the houses that they had been able to afford. They end up having to sell the houses quickly, or trying to get rid of those houses. And then they have to take less for it. That's where they get underwater. They owe more on the house than they can get for it, because people don't want to buy it for the high interest rate. So that's where you create a housing crisis. That there were several factors, but that was part of it there. And we've got a situation now where people are out running and buying houses, and that's for a number of reasons. People want to move out of the cities. The COVID thing sort of drove people to let's get out of the inner city and get out to the suburbs and get a house. So that's part of it. Prices are going up, and people were doing a little better. People have more income. There's right now, the latest figure, I think, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there's about $2.3 trillion that people have just sitting in accounts from the pandemic, not being able to buy things, not being able to travel, and also stimulus money coming out and other things. So you got $2.3 trillion sitting in bank accounts that's ready to be spent, and people are wanting to start to spend that, and that's going to drive up prices. We're seeing that.
Right.
The big debate right now, of course, is this temporary or is it permanent? My guess, it's a little bit both. I suspect some of this is temporary, but some of it's going to be permanent. And we don't know how much of the permanent's going to stay there.
Brad's interview continues after you hear from our generous sponsors.
I tell you, my heart really goes out to those like me who are self-employed.
Michael Hurley of Hurley Benefit Services.
Self-employed individuals have really been the very cornerstone of my agency.
If you're self-employed, you have a special health insurance problem.
I'm trying to help the individual out there who makes too much to qualify for any help, any subsidy or benefits from the government towards their health insurance, but does not have the income to pay the incredibly high premiums we find if you're buying your insurance individually. I'm a policyholder myself. I sleep better at night knowing that I have this coverage in place in a way that won't break the bank and allows me to keep my family covered if something tragic does happen.
Life, health, dental. With the innovative coverage offered by Hurley Benefit Services, you can have individual or group coverage that is a lot better, that costs a lot less. Hurley Benefit Services is independently owned, and they're online at hurleybenefits.com. H-U-R-L-E-Y benefits.com.
Sharing stories that matter. Here's your Texas anchorman, Robert Pratt, with Pratt on Texas.
Well, that's what concerns me. You had this piece in the Daily Caller where Yellen acknowledged that there may be a, quote, spurt in prices as a result of higher spending, but that would be that it would be temporary. Well, we hope. And it said higher inflation could contribute to the Fed deciding eventually to increase interest rates, which they actually, and she says that would be a good thing for the economy. I don't know about that. I don't like the government trying to, you know, turn the dials and pull the levers on the economy, because the it seems much better. I'm of the Steve Forbes model. It's much better to just have a really strong currency, keep it strong, keep its value, and let the market work these things out largely. If there's a big demand for loans, then interest rates go up. If there's not a big demand for loans, then interest rates go down, just like with the prices of hamburgers. And, you know, if it's temporary because of pent-up spending, fine. But, you know, what about all the businesses like me? We all have contracts with people. We've, you know, I can't just go, I've told people, okay, here's the rate. And maybe it's good for a year. Maybe it's good for 2 years. Okay. What do I do when all of a sudden all my prices rise 20%, you know, or 10%? Depends what you're doing. In some little parts of the economy, it is really high increases right now. What do? You can't go to your customers. They're suffering the same thing. They don't have more money to pay you. You end up losing customers if you ask and you go out of business. As a small businessman, I think an inflationary environment like this, whether it's temporary, a spurt, or long-term, is almost as dangerous as recession, in a sense. There's a lot of money being spent, but we can't pull it in the front side quickly enough to balance the increase in costs on the backside.
Right. Now, the Federal Reserve Bank has been trying to keep, has had a target of 2% inflation. That's been its target for some years now. Some years it gets it, some years it's in the early 2000, I'm looking at the rates right now. 2012, it was 1.7. 2013, 1.5. It was less than 1% 2014 and 15. But in the last 5 years or so, it's run right about 2% or a little over. And now we've had this big jump in it. And I've never quite understood the Fed's argument is we want 2% inflation because we're afraid of deflation, where prices start falling, and most consumers would be happy to see prices start falling.
Well, that's part of the pernicious nature of this Keynesian or whatever it is type government managing the economy. You've heard all this about negative interest rates and all of this stuff. Prices falling is a good thing in that the prices fall for everybody, and your currency keeps its value that way. You know, the last big run-up in oil prices we saw, where we were over $100 a barrel, was not because oil actually became that much more expensive or short. It was because of the value of the dollar. As the dollar right. became less valuable, that meant it took more of those U.S. dollars to purchase a barrel of oil. People at home thought, oh man, oil is booming, but actually, effectively, it was still in the 75, you know, $55 to $75 about a barrel value when it comes to actual. I guess you would call it a steady value, a real value. It's when let me skip forward. Senator Cruz wrote a piece in the Dallas Morning News, inflation could wreck American wealth. Well, that is true. And all of us who remember what happened, I mean, I came from a farm family. You know, I don't know what the figure was, but that last round of inflation in the 70s, and then when it got ended, put more family farms out of business than anything I think in American history, more than technology or anything. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, all of a sudden you weren't making good money. You had bad years. You could borrow because the value of your land was rising on paper. But then right. The minute inflation stops, it's like playing musical chairs. The one that's sitting there that's borrowed, same with these real estate speculators. You mentioned it in the housing crisis. They were doing the same thing in the 70s. I mean, all of a sudden, these people lose everything, and there's no way to recover because the numbers, there's just no way. I'm very frightened by this talk about inflation would be good, because the people we have in the White House, these are people who don't know anything, or they're pernicious to begin with. They love this European stagnation model.
They do. They like that, and it's another thing from Europe they'd like to be able to import. But the interest rate that the Fed has, the two things that really concern us right now, I think, is the amount of money the Fed has created. in doing all this quantitative easing. The Fed's starting to meet today. It'll meet today and tomorrow, and then we'll see what happens. But the stock market gets very nervous at this time, because even if the Fed says we're going to start, we're starting to begin thinking, by next year we'll begin thinking about how we may try to unwind all this money in 2 years out or 3 years out, and it just sends the market into a tizzy. Because the market really likes this cheap money out there that pulls money off of other things and puts it in the market and pushes up market prices.
Well, that's another example that a lot of people had missed, Dr. Matthews, about inflation. You can have a general average of inflation like this 2% we've been talking about, but then you can have inflation in particular areas that are much greater than that. I have friends that say, look, this cheap money in the market went up even under the, even though the economy didn't grow worth a darn under Obama, and that was the worst recovery, in the modern history of the West, basically, from a deep recession. So it was terrible. But people said, oh, look at my 401k. They weren't self-employed people like me that don't have all that. Maybe they had a big company and they were contributing to it for a long time. And they were saying, well, look at that. I mean, this is now worth $800,000. It was only worth $600,000 a few years ago. And then I asked them a question. How much did you pay for that house 9 years ago, 12 years ago? And they would tell me, and maybe it was, I'm out in West Texas, maybe it was $180,000. And now it's worth $280,000 or whatever. In other words, I pointed out to them, have you actually achieved more money? You have to stop and look at things. How much more do vehicles cost? And when people start looking at that, yes, sometimes they have achieved a net gain, but it's never the net gain that they think it is, because the prices of things have gone up. And this is what I think the average person, including good working people, don't quite understand about inflation. All the restaurants are raising prices. Look, there's pent-up demand, wage problems and things like that, and trying to get people to go to work. The government's been behind that. But I'll tell you what it does. It eventually means we eat out less, because our incomes, just like in the 70s, can't keep up with the rate of inflation. Now, if you leave that alone, the market takes care of itself eventually. But you've wrote a piece at IPI.org, Biden's backdoor scheme for effectively raising the minimum wage. And I'm sorry, this is nothing but another one of these leftist things that creates inflation, and it creates it for the poorest people. And they always suffer the most in these situations. The poor, the working poor, suffer the most from inflation. And yet the left has always tried to paint it as if it's something that's good for them. Well, that's crazy. They don't own a lot of physical assets. Often they own none, no appreciating assets. So as the prices go up, it just eats into their meager wages. Explain what's going on, though, with this backdoor scheme to raise the minimum wage.
Well, of course, the Democrats want to go to a $15 an hour minimum wage. They're apparently not going to be able to get that through, even through what we call the reconciliation process, because it doesn't have a major impact on the budget, and they don't have the votes to get over a filibuster on that, so they're probably not going to get it. So in the American Rescue Plan, they threw an extra $300 a week for people who are unemployed on top of the state unemployment benefits, and that has, Bank of America says, if you were making less than, say, $32,000, $33,000 a year, you're probably better off on the unemployment benefits. And now we see the situation across the country where employers are trying to get people, they're begging people to come back to work, and a percentage of them, especially in the sort of the lower middle income ranges, just are not wanting to come back to work right now. Biden has been criticized that it's this additional $300 that's making it attractive for people to stay out of the workforce, especially if you're not in a career job that you think, this is where I want to be. I'll go back to work even if I'm not, even if I'm not making as much as I would unemployed, because I've got a great future and I'm going to get raises and so forth. Some people are just not doing that. So Biden essentially said, look, I don't think this is happening, but if you'll just raise your wages out there, people will be coming back to work. And that's what's happening across the country.
But it was already happening before. That's what's interesting.
It was happening before, absolutely.
This minimum wage argument's become really stupid at the low end over the last many years.
Right. And
most people are paying well above the minimum wage.
Wages were rising under the Trump administration because the economy was doing well. Now they're rising because the economy is not doing well, but the government's paying people not to work. And
visiting with Dr. Merrill Matthews, we had a little trouble with the phone system that's usually so reliable, but we got him back. It may sound a little different. We're on a different connection. Dr. Matthews, you were just pointing out the government's paying people not to work. Now, Texas made the decision that I think 21 or more states now have made to stop this extra stipend of unemployment. I had a restaurateur tell me personally that he had employees say, we're making more money staying home. We're not going to come back to work. He said there were some really good employees who were back the moment they could get in there, even during the lockdowns. And there are people who wanted to work and they understand this stuff. But he said there were people that literally, it wasn't speculation. They actually said, hey, I mean, I'm getting paid more to stay home and I'm getting paid more on unemployment. I'm not coming back to work till that ends. And, of course, those, as he pointed out, that's not really the kind of people we want long term. But, my gosh, you know, beggars can't be choosers when you're trying to get people staffed and run a business. And I've been to restaurants. I went to a national chain, big one, based in Dallas. Isabel and I did after church in a neighboring city. We went visited another church. We went there after church, and the door was locked. They were doing send home stuff, take home stuff, but they had us note, so we can't get enough people to work, and so we're not going to be able to open until late this afternoon. I mean, this is terrible.
And it's worse than that. They'll sort of say, well, nobody would stay home for just the $300 extra a week and then the state unemployment. But remember, you also have Obamacare. If you're lower income, you can go to Obamacare and have taxpayers cover most or all of your health insurance premiums. That's a big plus. And then we've got the child tax credit coming starting in July. That's going to provide millions of Americans with extra money. And, of course, if you've got a three-year-old child, they're not spending the money. It's mom and dad that get to spend the money and on however they need to use it. And so you're right. About half the states now, every one of them, Republican-led, has said they're going to end the credit early. So you've got Texas is going to end it at the end of June. Several others are going to end it at the end of July. That credit automatically goes away at the end of September. Democrats had wanted to continue the $300 a week unemployment benefits, but Biden has said it's time to end it at the end of September. So my guess is we'll see come mid-September, we're probably going to see a number more people deciding it's time to go to work.
How does all of this economists love to make their field very vague so that they can say anything and get away with it. Just like the mystics and the wizards and everybody else that like to do. But a lot of this stuff, it's not that it's so vague. It's just that the economy and human beings' actions are so complex and so hard to predict. But we do know certain things. I mean, we know that if you devalue the currency, everything costs more. If you don't produce real gains in productivity, you don't see economic growth. You don't see wealth. In other words, the betterment of people do not become better off. What does all this put together lead to at this point? More questions than answers, or should we rightly be as fearful as some people were about when Obama got elected and when Biden? Because things just never seem to click there. But with Biden and his crew in there, I mean, they don't seem to have any sense of fiscal discipline. The Republicans haven't been good at it either. But, I mean, this is unbelievable what's going on. What should we be thinking? What should we be scared about?
Absolutely unbelievable. Even when Republicans were saying, okay, we're willing to go with some of the infrastructure spending, but let's use some of the money that was dedicated towards COVID relief and other things that's just sitting in the accounts right now, never been used. And so we'll put some new money at it, but we'll pull on this money that's sitting over in an account. And Biden doesn't want to do that. I mean, I'm amazed at this stuff. that they don't seem to understand that.
Pratt's interview continues after the break.
A Texas Aggie from the big country said he and his wife visited Dr. Silvia Zuniga at Dental Care in Costa Rica, spent about $7,000 on the entire trip, and yet saved over $5,000. He asked, how could it be any better? Our Aggie friend and listener wrote, thank you for recommending Sylvia. Her work and service was what you said it would be, very good. It took me several months of listening to you and researching on the internet to finally decide to do it. So glad I did. He added that the dental work he had done would have been about $12,000 at home, and of course that wouldn't have come with a fun vacation in which he and his wife toured volcanoes, hot springs, a nature and wildlife park, a coffee farm, a central market, and took a riverboat ride, went ziplining, and dined at some nice restaurants. Learn more about Dr. Silvia Zuniga and Dental Care by clicking the banner at PrattOnTexas.com. Finally, having your teeth fixed and beautiful can be affordable and even fun.
With the stories that matter, it's your Texas political swami, Robert Pratt, on Pratt on Texas.
And of course, in you're talking about inflation. With inflation, if you're paying more for something, but you're not getting more for it, we pay more for cars these days than we did 20 years ago, but we got much more in the cars.
Right.
But if you're just paying workers more without getting more productivity out of it, that's inflationary, and that's going to, even though I suspect some of these price surges will probably mellow out and calm down in 3, 4, 5 months as the supply chains and so forth, the people you're paying more right now for working, they're not going to want to see their incomes go down. So some of this is just going to filter through to higher prices all the way across the board. But Robert, the big problem here is the pandemic has always put this question on, you know, how is this going to play out? It was hard to expect at the beginning of last year when the stock market started tanking and the economy shutting down. Did you expect the stock market to come back as fast and as strongly as it did? You could make the case that it wouldn't have, but it did. And so I just don't know how the pandemic and the government's response to it has created so many question marks that it's hard for me to sort of say this is really going to be a catastrophe for us. It may round itself out, but we've put in motion the elements of a catastrophe. Whether or not that actually plays out, it's just hard for me to guess.
Yeah, and that's the hard part. You mentioned supply chain, so I want to continue this with one other issue. I read G Captain. It's kind of the big independent site for the global shipping industry for at sea.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been watching a lot of this stuff, and they had a story, I think Reuters, I don't remember who originated it. I saw it last night. And they were shocked because they haven't seen anybody do this. Home Depot has now leased a container ship to do nothing but go back and forth for it solely, because the supply chains are so backed up. And I've been reading the details. I can't explain this to the audience in any quick amount of time. It's not just
right.
Because there was a fire here or the, and it's not all the pandemic either. It is the global supply chains are so messed up. I mean, these shipping companies, Maersk and others, talking about, you know, massive shipping rate increases for the next at least 2 years. It's really quite fun to read about because it is so complex. But here's Home Depot said we can't even, you know, they even said they've been paying a hell of a lot extra to fly things on airplanes from suppliers to here, higher margin items, just to get it in the stores, because you can't, in the rule in retail,
right,
folks, you can't sell it if you don't have it, and thus you go broke. They have just leased one of these big ships to do nothing but go back and forth. They're looking at trying to integrate now. That's not new in an economic sense, in that vertical integration, including supply chains, used to be something that was sort of the norm. I mean, Walmart's model of tracking store sales and then having their own distribution and within their retail environment, that was one of their great achievements that stomped Kmart out of the leading position. But I mean, now we're talking about all the way back to the factory. I mean, it reminds me of an earlier day. Are we seeing the breakup of the just-in-time inventory, or are we just seeing, Because I think there's so much value in that. That's why the whole world went to it. I can't imagine that just going away. Or do you think we're going to see a hybrid in the future where companies do tend to go back to having some of their own distribution? I mean, you're talking about companies, manufacturers bringing it in, but look at Amazon. I mean, they became so big. They're the biggest customer for all the shippers out there, but they also are building their own on the retail side of it back out. Are we moving back to an era of a hybrid nature where, you know, you used to see all those private train cars on the railroad that were owned by the biggest shippers, and mixed with just buying time on other people's transport? Your thoughts? Have you read anything about that?
Two or three things that I think we don't know yet. Number one, if the market stays open and companies can innovate, they may find various ways to sort of address this problem of the supply chain roadblocks that we have right now. So that's one aspect of. On the other hand, you've got Joe Biden who wants to try to force all these companies back so that the essentially the whole supply chain is within the U.S. I think that's just companies were reshoring under Trump, but that was because you had lower tax rates and a good regulatory environment. The only reason they offshored was because
to get away from
not
it.
The only reason, but they were inverting in their companies. So you don't actually hear much about inversions anymore because so many companies said, "Hey, we can come back here, work out of the United States, have a decent regulatory environment and low tax rate. That's a place for us to be." Biden's trying to change all that. And that's what creates an awful lot of the offshoring that they have to try to meet in order to be able to make all the products. So I'm completely mystified as to how this is going to play out, because if you let companies innovate, my guess is they'll find ways to do that, and they'll build on sort of a model where they're doing some of the transporting and other things themselves because they can vertically integrate and handle it. But I don't know that Biden allows that, or if they try to force everything back on the U.S., creating other problems. And of course, you've got China, and companies have been moving out of China for a while. My guess is the tension with China is going to accelerate that. That may put us over more in Vietnam and other places where companies were moving to try to get lower cost and other things, but do you allow that if you're trying to force these companies back? It's a complete mystery to me.
Well, I was just the whole shipping industry was shocked by this decision by Home Depot. They just haven't seen this, you know, to have its own lease, its own major freighter just to meet its needs. And I'm just looking at that saying, my goodness, the folks that are really hip deep in this who depend on that supply chain, particularly on the retail side, but of course we've been hearing a lot about it on the automobile side, on the manufacturing side.
Right.
You know, there are car lots here don't have any cars on them. I mean, there's a big one here in town that doesn't have any. There's nothing on the new car side of it. It's interesting. The market will recover, but that's what bothers me is exactly what you're talking about. When politicians start getting into the middle of it and trying to force their view of how things should work, it slows the ability of the market to react properly and sometimes can even stop it. And that's a real danger to everyone. And shortages can create inflation. Shortages create inflation too. If they're just pure natural shortages, that's a good thing. But when they're contrived shortages by government policy or getting in the way, it just becomes another pernicious form of inflation.
And I would encourage your listeners, I wrote a piece to go online and look at an article that was written in 1950, in the late 1950s, called iPencil by Leonard Reed.
It's fabulous.
Who founded the Foundation for Economic Education. And I did a piece shortly, you can also get a link to it on a piece I did at IPI.org on iPencil, because iPencil sort of talks about how hard it is for anybody to any government or any individual to sort of just build a pencil because there's so many elements to it. And I use that to highlight the supply chain aspect, because all of this is supply chain stuff where, you know, loggers who are going to cut the wood for pencils, they go out and they buy the saws and other things, but nobody sort of creates the saws and makes, no government does that. they go out and find those things. And this is all integrated supply chains where individuals looking for needs and markets out there find a way to make those things happen at the most efficient way, at the lowest price, and have it ready available. And the government's trying to rethink supply chains now, and that concerns me a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, no kidding, iPencil, it's one of the absolute classics if you want to understand how economics works in a marketplace. Dr. Merrill Matthews is a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation in, I guess, the Dallas area is where you guys are based. Yeah. IPI.org is the website. You can read his pieces there. Sign up for their email list. Get his pieces as they come out. They're always enjoyable. And like the morning updates I did for over a decade, they're fairly short and sweet and a nice, easy read. And we all appreciate that. Dr. Matthews, thanks for the time. I appreciate you very much and the work you do. And when you get any more clarity on this crystal ball on what's going on, you just send me an email and we'll get you on the record here and see if your prediction's any better than anybody else's. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for all you've done. I mean, you've been a voice for freedom and liberty and sound economic thinking for years and years, and I just appreciate all your work.
Thanks, Dr. Matthews. I'll send you a check. Appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.
Wish to comment on a story? Send an email. Visit the contact page at prattontexas.com or join the listener club and get that direct to Pratt email address.